For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Tonight we're going to do the third part of our consideration of this notion of general revelation. So far we've seen pretty potent evidence of the existence of an infinite personal God, a creator God. And I'm not going to belabor that anymore. Some of the, you know, we've looked at a couple lines of evidence. There's several more, actually. But we'll accept that that is a point that's been made. But no sooner do you acknowledge the likelihood of an infinite personal God, than another major question comes up, and that is the problem of evil. This is the premier argument that is raised up against the biblical idea of an infinite personal God. Anywhere you go where people are, you know, you can go onto websites and books and so forth that are putting down the idea of God, invariably this is the main problem that they camp around. So it's very important for those of us who are Christians to become conversant with the whole issue and to get biblical answers for it, because I think it is answered biblically in an extremely satisfying way, amazingly satisfying way, more satisfying than any other worldview. That's my opinion. I'll let you judge that for yourself. Here's the problem. If God created the world and he's supposed to be so good, how come the world he created is so evil? We say God is all powerful, God is all good, and yet evil exists. Well, last week we were arguing, you know, that it's a problem when you're inconsistent with your own assumptions, your own presuppositions. Opponents and critics would say, well, you're being inconsistent with your presuppositions. If God was all powerful, he would be able to stop evil. If he was all good, he would want to stop evil. And yet evil exists. And so you have an internal contradiction right there in your so-called all-good, all-powerful God. Well, I can see the problem. I understand it. I used to roll this one out myself as an atheist. So we want to think tonight about what has God done about the existence of evil in the world. And consider this whole question tonight, because it really comes up in Romans chapter 1. This picture isn't super clear, but I hope you can see. It's actually better when you can see the faces on the guys. This is a World War II shot of a fascist soldier with a pistol getting ready to shoot a defenseless Jewish peasant in the head and have him tumble. This is actually a still taken from a clip, a movie. I've seen the movie. He did shoot him. And probably his family's already lying in the pit. The guys behind him standing around, you know, smiles on some of their faces, having a good time. And, you know, it's kind of like, hey, my turn. What are we looking at here? We're looking at the naked truth. Evil exists. When we look at a scene like this, we're not just looking at something that is maladaptive to the species. We're not just looking at something that is pragmatically not useful. We're looking at something that is morally wrong, should not happen. You know, it's easy for us in bourgeois America to have such sheltered lives that sometimes the full scope of evil is somewhat sheltered away, and the proof of that is that there are some who still argue that humans are fundamentally good. Boy, talk about blind faith. That's a heavy one to swallow. Here's one of our points, though, that we need to start with, and I always like to start with this point. A lot of people feel like, well, evil is a big problem for theists and Bible believers, and so it is. But it's not just a problem for us. This is a problem for anyone, no matter what their worldview is. We kind of noted this last week, didn't we? Let's think about atheism or naturalism or agnosticism, views that reject the idea that a God exists. What's their explanation? Well, they've got huge problems in this area. They can't even say what evil is. under a materialistic model, what is right. You know, it's just what happened. Maybe a lion pride encroaches on another pride's territory. The males fight to the death sometimes. It happens a lot. What are we to say? Oh, we should imprison that lion that killed the other lion. Oh, hell no. That's just their, you know, it's nature. It's just their material beings. They fight, they kill, whatever. An ant war, you know, many deaths. It's just nature. It's the way things are. And so why would humans be any different? It's just like, what is right under atheism can't even, has no basis for saying that anything is evil. That's a pretty big problem, I think. Whatever is right. At most, they could argue that some things might be disadvantageous to the survival of the species. But that begs the question, as we saw last week, why should our species be the only one that gets to survive, and who cares anyway? And by the same token, you could easily argue that going out tonight and eliminating a quarter of the population of Earth, all the aged, infirm, disabled, genetically flawed in any way, might well enhance the survivability of our species. And when naturalists have taken control of government, that's exactly the way they've acted. Anybody who is a problem is snuffed, and you have tens of millions mowed down by naturalistic, atheistic thinkers like Stalin, like Mao. They're not just talking about it, they do it. The greatest atrocities in the history of the world, oh yeah, there have been atrocities committed by religious people. Massive ones. Nothing like what the naturalists have done, though. The naturalists take the cake when it comes to atrocity. And no wonder, since humans are nothing but a material object, why should we worry about them? Let's think about pantheism. We saw last week that pantheism posits a God who is all and in all. He's in the peasant about to be shot in the head, but he's equally in the guy doing the shooting. And that's why Eastern thinkers come to argue that dichotomies like good and evil are really unenlightened thinking, that properly understood, it's all part of the whole, the all. And so, once again, that's a problem. That's a huge problem. They don't even believe that the evil that we think we perceive here is real. We live in samsara or maya, a word that comes from a Sanskrit word meaning illusion. This whole world isn't even really happening. So there's a denial of the reality of evil here. And two, then, karmic law explains why some people have it good and some have it bad. Whatever this peasant did that caused his death, he probably had it coming. And he probably committed something in his previous life that came back against him, so he got shot and killed. And so there's no basis for really resisting evil here. It's just everybody deserves it. That's a problem. Oh yeah, you got huge problems no matter where you turn. We go into animism, the other major worldview in the world today and throughout history, the predominant one really. This is the biggest. Numerically, more people are animistic probably than any other faith. They got a massive problem here because in their thinking, there is no problem of evil. In animism, the gods are also evil. Rape, murder, lying, you name it. If you study mythology, if you study folklore, they've got stories where their gods do the same thing that the rest of humanity does. And so there is no basis here at all for even an evaluation of the problem. They think everything that happens are the result of spirits influencing things. And they have taboos, but taboos are different than moral thinking. For one thing, they aren't principles that can be taken into different situations and applied like a moral norm can. Rather, they're specific to a particular behavior by a particular tribe. such as not doing your laundry on Tuesdays, because that would offend the gods. It's not really, most moral thinkers agree that taboos are not, don't qualify as moral thinking in our sense of the word. So no matter where you turn in the world, it's not like we are getting these awesome answers to this problem that really, you know, are satisfying and fill in the blanks. And that's a good thing to remember. I've had people come at me aggressively before, oh yeah, what about evil? And I always like to say, yeah, well, what's your explanation? You know, oh, I don't know. Oh. Well, then, I guess any answer would be better than that, wouldn't it? Let's think about biblical theism. And there is a difference between biblical theism. There are other theisms, belief in God, that are not necessarily biblically based. But I'm speaking here in biblical terms. The first thing that we have to come to grips with is this notion of personhood. A personal being is a being created on a very high order. They have self-awareness. We recognize this. I can sit and think, I'm aware of my life, my presence as an individual, my history, my future. Research indicates that other animals do not have this. This is uniquely human, this ability to recognize the self. We see humans behaving in a way that is more destructive, more evil than other species, and that suggests that there's something different about us as well. Like that picture we saw, you know, you wouldn't see another species doing something like that. That peasant doesn't pose any threat to them. It's not a source of food. It's just brutality for the sake of brutality. And that squares with the fact that, you know, particularly in the biblical view, this highly sophisticated, advanced spiritual being that has been created here is in a fallen state. And so not only are we capable of higher highs, but lower lows than a material organism would be. We think of human sexuality, how different it really is from animal sexuality. Animal sexuality bears all the marks of being for procreation. You ever thought about that? How it is that other mammals, for example, won't engage in sex unless it's for procreation. The female's not receptive unless she's an estrus. Not true with humans. Humans are easily the sexiest creature on earth. We're all over that all the time, anytime. And it's done with no relationship to fertility at all. It's done as God signaled in his creation of humans, that this was a two becoming one. This was a mode of fellowship and an expression and celebration of oneness that fits, frankly, what we see in human behavior, but does not really fit a picture of humans as just one more material species. An animal species, how come we're so different? Where are the intervening species between humans and the nearest thing? In a number of areas, we just stand out as this oddball species. We think of intellect. If you had an intelligence graph, you know, that plotted the relative intelligence of every species, of a million different species of animal on Earth, there'd be a lot of points on that graph. And the curve would be very smooth. In fact, the difference between any two points on there would be so close together, only an expert could tell the difference, and even they disagree. For instance, there's debate about what the second most intelligent creature on earth is today, although I think most authorities still think it's the chimpanzee. But there are a couple of other candidates that increasingly are being speculated that they may be more intelligent even than the chimps, but it's hard to tell because they're so close together. Then all of a sudden, boom, comes a huge bar leaping up into the sky. It's humans. Oh man, way more intelligent than anything else. Why aren't there some, we would anticipate some intervening steps there. Can you think of any species that stands out that much in any feature? Flight, hearing, sight, speed of running, whatever you name, there's something else very close in that very behavior. And yet here is a whole area where humans are just, boom, way out of the world. You know, you say, well, birds can fly, humans can't do that. Well, humans do fly. They fly at least 20, 100 times the speed of birds. We're way out there. Good Lord, we fly to the moon. Now, there's nothing else like that. That's not what you would expect under just a purely Darwinian, you know, material model. You know, Darwinism and natural selection might explain a lot. I think it does, in fact. And yet, the Bible declares at a certain point that God intervened in whatever sequence was there and created humans and imbued them with a spirit that made them qualitatively different than the rest of the animal world, that he created humans in his own image, fashioned them after himself. You know, these facts that we're talking about fit the biblical picture, but they don't really fit the materialistic picture. Everywhere we go on earth, humans are exactly the same. They're all interfertile. They all believe in the religion. They all believe in an afterlife. We've never found a culture that doesn't believe in that. They're all of the same intellect. Interesting. Like people in the deepest jungle. There was a notorious case in the 70s where National Geographic reported on a tribe in Philippines discovered back in a rainforest there that was so primitive. They had not developed any moral standards. Anything went. They didn't believe in marriage. They didn't believe in any sexual norms. They didn't have any religion. Didn't believe in an afterlife. They were like, they were the missing link. Okay, they looked like humans, but they didn't have a lot of these features and stuff. I remember, it was made national news. Now, I'm old enough to remember this crap. I was stumbled. I was. I thought, that can't be. It's not possible. It didn't. That flatly contradicted my worldview. I was like, God, what is this supposed to mean? What are these? Wasn't true. The whole thing was a big scam. And these Filipino guys, along with a couple of Westerners, knew that the sociologists and anthropologists from Geographic wanted to find something like this. And they told them they had found it, took them back and showed them these guys. But they had paid the natives to act. And so National Geographic, eventually it came out, National Geographic issued a big apology and stuff. This is quite a fiasco. And they had a special on like 2020 or one of those in the 90s where they were showing these clips of the guy, you know, not there naked, you know, with a stick for a spear. And these guys were Stone Age, you know, had no metal, couldn't do anything like that. And then they showed the same guy dressed, you know, in normal clothes, and he was like, yeah, they gave me $100 to do this. They cleaned up, they cleaned him up for like $50,000 on this scam. Hell no, there's no tribe like that. Nothing like that exists. Humans are distinctly human everywhere. Nothing between them and the next group. They all have moral emotions. There's no group that doesn't have moral. A sense that things should, that there should be a moral standard of some kind. Aesthetic fascination is worldwide. You know, humans have this thing about creativity, about beauty, and they will spend a huge amount of time. It's true here in the West. You know how much time you spend on your iPod or whatever. But it's true around the world. It's true throughout history, too. I mean, even the most primitive tribes spend all of this time in carvings, in tattoos, and all of these different ways of creating beauty, and a huge amount of time is devoted to that. That doesn't put any food on the table. That doesn't build a shelter. You know, that doesn't breed new young. It seems like a big waste of time, but it fits perfectly with the notion that we're created in the image of God, who is also very creative, who also has this sense of beauty and loves to create beauty. Yeah. Personhood. very important. This is the verse in Genesis that says, "So God created people in His own image. He patterned them after Himself, and male and female He created them." That's the beginning point. You have to come to grips with the fact that we're dealing, when we deal with humans, we're dealing with a being created in the image of God. Now, what if you had a fragment of a book that you could, you know, pick certain facts out of, but it's very fragmentary, and so you're wondering, you know, kind of like, what's the rest of the story, because we can only look at part of it here, and then you discover, you know, buried somewhere, you dig up another piece of a book, and it looks like it might be the missing part. You get the part you find and line it up with what you know, and you start to realize, you check it at several different points, you start to realize, whoa, this is it. This is the missing piece. And so, in this illustration, the fragmentary understanding that you would have would correspond to what we can see about ourselves. We read the verse last week that says that God, that which is known about God, is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. We can look within ourselves and recognize signs of personhood there, signs that we're different. We know this. We can sense it intuitively. And yet, we need to know more. And so when we come and we pull out the Bible and we line it up with human nature, we start to find this incredible alignment that at point after point, that which we see about ourselves is perfectly matched by the text of the Bible. Then at that point, we can turn to the other pages and read with confidence and learn the rest of the story about human nature. This is an illustration by author Francis Schaeffer in the book, The God Who's There. The mannishness of man, as he calls it, that sense of that we are this lofty being with all of these traits and so forth, finds a perfect explanation in the text of the Bible. And that gives us confidence in the rest of what the Bible says as well. Why is it so important? In the first place, only a personal being can even do something that's evil. The illustration earlier of the lion killing the other lion, an ant killing an ant. So what happens, right? It's not a moral event. To be capable of evil, you have to be a personal being. And to be personal implies that we're non-programmed beings, that we are capable of making decisions, making choices that are free and are therefore culpable. So if my son is beating his brother with a stick, I don't come and take the stick and, you know, lecture that, right? The stick's just a material object. It does what it's programmed, what it's made to do. Stick is not culpable. It's the personal being wielding the stick. That's the one that's culpable. We all can see that perfectly well. I don't know, though. I've had a lot of people, I've had a lot of conversations with people that don't believe in God and stuff, and I've very often heard people say, well, why didn't God just create free choosing beings that never choose evil? Okay. That is just semantic nonsense, all right? What does the word free mean? If it's free, but it has to do this or it can't do that, well, it's not really free then, is it? Free means F-R-E-E, free. And to be a personal being, you cannot be a pre-programmed machine that is compelled to do certain things. That's impersonal by definition. A movie recently came out that kind of illustrated this. Did any of you see Invasion? Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig, yeah. I thought it was watchable. Has a high level of tension. It's a remake of an old horror movie where this virus-like organism comes to Earth in the crash of the Challenger, and people touch it and it invades them, and then while they sleep, it fuses with their nervous system and takes them over, and then it's spread very rapidly to where most of the human race is now infected with this, and the effect it has is that it takes over their thought processes and turns them into well-behaved, you know, compliant, good people. And so in the course of the movie, you know, they have these news broadcasts on in the background. They're signing a peace treaty in Iraq. Everybody, you know, North Korea's opened up to the public. They're disarming. Everybody's, you know, all the problems of the earth. Hadn't been a murder in 20 days now and stuff like that. And so the whole human race starts to behave. But you get this super creepy feeling. It makes your flesh crawl to think of being taken over that way, and they're clearly subhuman. They become strangely impersonal because they don't have the ability to choose evil anymore. Here's a clip where Nicole realizes that Craig has been infected.
No, just listen to me.
Not you.
Dr. Craig!
Hey, Ollie.
Get away from him! You come here!
Carol.
Get away! Get away from us!
Carol, look at yourself. Is this who you are? Is this who you want to be? We were wrong to fight them.
No.
Do you remember our trip up to Colorado? Do you remember the Aspen Grove?
Shut up! Shut up!
How beautiful and peaceful it was. Remember what you said to me?
I didn't say anything to you!
You wondered what it'd be like if people could live more like those trees. Completely connected with each other, in harmony. As one.
You're not, Ben. I know you're not Ben.
I'm not just Ben. I'm more than Ben.
Stop! Don't open that door!
Have you seen the television? Have you read the newspapers? Seen what's happening here, what we're offering? A world without war, without poverty, without murder, without rape. A world without suffering. Because in our world, no one can hurt each other or exploit each other or try to destroy each other, because in our world, there is no other. You know it's right, Carol. Deep down inside, you know that fighting us is fighting for all the wrong things. Carol, you know it's true. Our world is a better world.
Oh, man. A better world. We're all one. There is no other. Yeah, they completely lost their individuality, haven't they? It is kind of a, on one level, you say, yeah, man, things should be that way. On another level, it's nightmarish. It's gross. She's like she says, you're not Dan. You're not a person. And I thought it was good at illustrating that. Yeah, to be a personal being, you can't be programmed like that. But the problem is, you open the door to real freedom, anything can happen. Anything. And that is the door that God opened. Freedom of choice. He did it. He decided to do it. Now, at the same time, if you admit that free choosing beings have to be capable of freely choosing anything, then the issue of evil, there's certainly always a possibility that that choice for evil will be made. And if it is made, then who is responsible? If the choice is freely made, then the one making that free choice must be responsible for what is done. The concept of responsibility is linked directly to the concept of freedom of choice. Without freedom of choice, if people are being made to do what they do, they're not culpable, they're not responsible. And the Bible declares that even with us, after we've been fallen, a substantial measure of freedom remains in our choices. Back a long time ago, we're taught that the original humans chose to break with God. They chose to go their own way. They thought they had a better way than God's way. And this was the fall. I believe it was a historical event. I think it actually happened, and it perfectly explains why humans are the way they are. Now, their offspring were born fallen. Those offspring were born fallen, and it's come down to us. And we're taught in the Bible that we're born already with a tendency. Now, an inner damage that causes us to tend towards selfishness, to tend away from following God and to abhor authority and to take what we want, violence, if necessary, if we think that'll work, whatever, lying, doesn't matter. And so the question now comes up, how should God respond? What do you think God should do about this situation, having created free-choosing beings? They've revolted, they've created this hellish situation where people are rampaging all over the world. What should God do? Let's go back to our picture. Okay, this guy right here, this one with the gun, and his buddies too that are waiting for their turn. What should God do to these guys? What do you think? Nothing? Should it just be like, you know, they come to God after they're dead, and God's like, well, yeah, you probably shouldn't have done that, but, you know, whatever. Nothing? Is that satisfactory? No responsibility? Should he reward them? That's what universalists think. The universalist theory is that God is just so sweet and good that everybody gets to go to heaven. He would never do anything mean like judge anybody. You know, he's just, whatever. Really? For that act right there, so there is no answer, just here's your reward for a life well lived. Should God apologize and say, I'm sorry for creating this situation that caused you to be this way? That's what a lot of people think. He should apologize. It's his fault. Well, you can see if there's no responsibility for humans, then who is responsible? And it probably does go back to the one that made this mess. I can see that reasoning. On the other hand, if the man is not being made to do what he does here, if this guy is doing it because he chose to do it, that's a whole different picture. And I can't see God apologizing for anything in that case. The Bible says none of these are right. What's going to happen is that God is going to judge, he's going to hold accountable this man for what he did. And that we can anticipate the judgment of God. Because there is freedom, because there is responsibility, then there's also culpability. And therefore God will judge people who are guilty. So we stand under the judgment of God. Romans 1:21. Yes, they knew God, but they wouldn't worship Him as God or even give Him thanks. And they began to think up foolish ideas of what God was like. As a result, their minds became dark and confused. Claiming to be wise, they instead became fools. And instead of worshiping the glorious, ever-living God, they worshiped idols made to look like mere people or birds or animals or reptiles. Kind of the history of the world here. You know, we sense that there is a transcendent, infinite, personal God there, but that's scary. So we would rather have something more manageable here. So we carve, cut a tree, and we carve it into a figure and stand that up, and then, we bow down to that. The other half of the tree we use to cook our dinner with. That illustration from the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah's just, get a grip. Good Lord, you carved that. That's your God? Absurd. And we do the same thing today with the work of our hands, the things that we make. We'll worship that. That's our modern idol, our Wall Street idol. So nothing has changed. Anything except the true God, the one that scares us, the God who speaks, the God who judges, that God, we don't want anything to do with that. Therefore, God gave them over, we read, to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. Oh yeah, what's God going to do with people they refuse to acknowledge and they won't give thanks? They'd rather worship a piece of stone. What's He going to do? Well, I'll bet He'll just blow them away. He'll probably flame them with fire, right? No, something even worse than that. He just lets them go. Okay, do it your way. And that turns out to be a pretty intense judgment in its own right. He gave them over. He let them do. We read three times in this passage that he gave them over. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator. We know that the Creator's there, but we'd rather worship the creation. Things here that we know perfectly well are not really God. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts, rampaging. Pretty soon sex isn't enough. Perversion of every kind that terrorized the community. When they refused to acknowledge God, He gave them over to their evil minds and let them do things that should never be done. Their lives became full of every kind of wickedness, sin, greed, hate, envy, murder, fighting, deception, malicious behavior, and gossip. Sounds like the front page of the paper on tonight's table, doesn't it? They're backstabbers, haters of God, insolent, proud, boastful. They're forever inventing new ways of doing evil, disobedient to their parents. They refuse to understand, break their promises, heartless, unforgiving. And those are only their good points. Humanity. There it is. They're fully aware of God's death penalty for those who do such things, yet they go right ahead and do them anyway, and worse, they encourage others to do them too. So the Bible is telling us that the whole human race, this isn't just the other people, this is us, this is all of us, are hopelessly mired in personal sin and evil because we have turned away from God and He has just let us go, turned us loose. And so this brings us to the sin graph. Okay? Now, in the sin graph, shooting a defenseless old man, that is pretty freaking bad right there. Now that's disgusting, you know. Now, on the other hand, my lying, selfishness, my disregard of God, leading my own life my way, you know, it's like maybe a sex affair or two thrown in, whatever, stole something. I'm not saying I've never done anything, okay, but I mean, I've never done anything like that. I mean, that's disgusting. You know, if people are going to do something like shooting that poor guy there and probably his family with him and everything, and that kind of stuff, you know, it's like people like that, yes, maybe I can see where maybe it just is best if God sends them into hell. I mean, you know, they need to answer for that. But, well, people like me, I mean, I've never killed anyone. I've never done anything like that, right? That's the way we like to view the sin graph. Now, when we come to God's view, a little bit different than ours. We read in Proverbs 16, all the ways of a man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord weighs the spirit. He looks right past the superficials. He looks past our definitions, all of our rationalizations and excuses, and sees right to the spirit. And right there at that level, we're all alike. All of us. God's view of the sin graph is kind of a little more like this. Okay? Yeah, He would agree that shooting the old man was worse than just disregarding him and not following him, but his lines are a little bit longer on all of these things. Pretty bad as far as he's concerned. He thinks that those who deserve to go to hell include everyone on that graph. He's working on a different standard than we are. See, we're looking at it from within the soup. We're down in the mud, wallowing with the other pigs, so things look one way down there. He's looking at it from a position of absolute perfection. He's never sinned. He's never found the need to do any of those kind of things. He's a God of love and of giving. And so to him, it all looks pretty bad. Disregarding God. You know what Jesus said about that? He said, "He who is not with me is against me. And he who does not gather with me scatters." What should God do with humans who come against him? Well, people say, "Well, I'm not against God." Oh, yes, you are. Yeah, if you're maintaining that I don't need God, if you're maintaining I don't think I want to follow God, He says you do need me. You do need to follow me. You're a very lost person, in fact. And you're coming directly against Him on that point. You know, following God is not just a flavor of ice cream that might taste good if you feel like having some ice cream tonight. It's a moral obligation on every creature that has been created in God's image. He's God. He's the Creator. We're just creatures here. And so we should be willing to follow Him. And if we say, I don't see any need for that, then we are directly calling God a liar in His call that we do need to follow Him. Oh, that's pretty serious, all right. It's serious enough to land you into the judgment of God. Verse 32 says, people are fully aware of God's death penalty for those who do such things. I've talked to so many people where the subject of the judgment of God has come up and they're like, well, I'm just not going to follow God like that. If He's going to do something like that, I'm not interested. So what? What is, you know, so that's what you're going to tell God when you appear before Him someday. It offends me that you judge people, God. Objection overruled. Now get out of here. It's not up to our vote. Look, we may not like the judgment of God, and yet, I think we can see it. I think we can see why God would do this if we are free choosing and responsible beings. Well, the Bible declares the judgment of God is a very real thing. Dangerous. Scary. Of course we should be scared of it being judged by an almighty God. That's not going to be good. Well, it's a desperate situation. If we're all in the wrong place on the sin graph, and we stand under the judgment of God, we're heading toward a very negative future here. We've got major problems. Fortunately, according to the Bible, God has not left it there. That God has been very active in this whole thing. The picture could seem pretty passive at this point. He gives them over, He lets them do what they want, seems pretty passive, but He's actually been active the whole time. He had a plan right from the beginning. The plan was looking down at humanity. You know, God's righteous justice is stirred by that. He feels compelled by His own nature that I have to judge this. I cannot look away and pretend that didn't happen in that picture. It did happen. It needs to be answered for, and the justice has to be served with God. But He also has a somewhat contradictory feeling, which is that He's a God of love. And so these beings, humans, He loves them. He loves you. Loves me. But He feels compelled to judge us. So there's a dilemma here. That's what we were talking about in the story of the judge and the son, right? Is God going to service His own love for people and ignore His justice? No. That's not going to happen. Will He service His justice for people and ignore His love? No, as it turns out, that's not going to happen either. The solution is that Jesus came, that God came in the person of Jesus and absorbed His own judgment into Himself. Justice was served. Every evil was punished there on the cross by the infinite personal God Himself, incarnated into humanity. A solution so wild, it's just shocking. People are just like, I just can't believe that God would do something like that. Yeah, He did it. If we can believe the Bible, He did it. He did the unthinkable. The solution's so much more radical than anyone could guess. And so this whole problem, it turns out, has been solved. Even though we deserve the death sentence of God, the Bible declares we can get out of this. He's already paid away. But we have to receive that gift. That's one caveat. He's like, the free choice is still there. I'm not going to impose this on everybody. It's up to you. Do you want it? Or are you going to be so proud to say, even if God's going to give me eternal life and spare me from judgment free of charge, I'm not interested. Okay, then you won't be freed. When we say, I don't want to have Jesus pay for my sins, then we may not realize it, but we're really saying, I want to pay for it myself. And that's what's going to happen. Well, this is part of the biblical answer to the problem of evil. Amazingly to me, the more I've thought about this, the more every blank is filled in, except for this one. We haven't filled this one in. Why is he letting the situation go on? What's the point there? Why doesn't he at least intervene and put an end to this Holocaust that we live in here? Well, that's not our subject tonight, but it comes up later in Romans. You're going to have to keep studying Romans to get the full answer to that. I can just tell you this. He is going to intervene. That part's coming. Okay. But the reason why he hasn't done it already, the reason why he's putting it off, there's some very good reasons for that that have to do with the whole cosmic plan of God from eternity past to eternity future. And one of the awesome things that's going to come out of this is that this whole experiment with let's revolt against God and do things our way is going to be a one-time event. It happens here on earth. He lets it develop fully to the logical extreme, but because of the awfulness of what happens here and God's action in rescuing us out of it, we read that people will never be so foolish again. We'll remember this whole episode, and they'll be never be again, even though we're free as can be, as real, true personal beings. You know, there'll be a history to refer to. We saw what happened the last time they tried that. It wasn't a very good idea. Nobody's going to be tempted to go back there. And that result, affecting billions, to be sure, billions of the citizens of the universe, in God's mind, it was worth it. And that was his decision. Is it worth it? I can't judge that. I have no idea. I don't even know what he's basing it on. I don't know what the factors are. He felt that it was worth it. I guess it must be. I take it from, you know, he's pretty smart. He's pretty good, too. It must be worth it, or he wouldn't have done it. And there you have the biblical, kind of an outline of the biblical response to the problem of evil. I'm going to draw a line there for tonight. Next week, we're going to go into Romans 2, where he points out that religion, that God is against religion, that religion is a great deceiver, and that people who are religious, that it's a terrible thing because they think they're closer to God because of that, and they're no closer. Doesn't do a single bit of good. And then we'll read chapter 3, where he kind of summarizes the man without the Bible in chapter 1, the religious man in chapter 2, and sort of wraps it up and gives us a full picture of the work of Christ in this good news that this whole book's about. Okay? Lord, this is an amazing area just to think through. We realize that when we open your word, it does line up with everything we see within ourselves. It is the rest of the story, just like that book. And it's kind of hard to deny, because this interlocking system of truth you've revealed is so tight, it totally just has the ring of truth to it. And I don't think we would have ever come up with something like that. Lord, it's amazing, viewed then from your viewpoint, that you haven't just wasted every one of us here. I look on that list of things. I know there's a number of things right on that list I'm definitely guilty of. And yet, here is this amazing offer of the free gift, of the good news, that we can opt out of your judgment, and you're going to pick up the bill at the cross of Christ. Man, that part's unexpected. We didn't expect that. And it's mind-blowing, God, to realize that you are consistent with yourself. You're infinite, you're personal, you're just and fair, and yet you are as more loving than we ever would have guessed. That's exciting. I pray that anyone here, God, who senses inwardly the reality of these matters we're speaking of will call out to you in their hearts to know you, ask you, you know, God, reveal yourself to me, open my eyes and my heart to experience your reality in my life. Cause this death of Christ to apply to me so that I won't have to stand under your judgment. And we thank you for each person that may have called out to you that way here tonight, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.